Okay, thanks, Vincent. Especially thanks for not doing an introduction, because I know you're very serious about this. Somehow you managed to prevail on me to give a supposedly pedagogical lecture. You'll see to what extent I actually carried through on this. In order to be persuaded, I came up with the device of bringing in somebody to help. And Chenka here, if you don't know Chenka Zhu, he'll be here to do all the serious lecturing in the remaining weeks. Well, you'll see this one isn't that serious. So please get to know him. You can try and figure out which one he is on this picture. I'll give you the hint that he's not the best looking one. Honestly, when I agreed to do this first, I didn't realize that both programs would be going on. It's kind of not obvious how to talk to both of these audiences. Although I've been having a wonderful time going to the Colt Adams program the last month, especially last week's conference was pretty amazing. Giving a pedagogical lecture is always hard, and particularly you don't know what the audience actually wants to hear. So I decided to sort of dodge that question with this first lecture. Rather than really be pedagogical, just give you kind of a list, a quick taste, if you want, of topics that I thought might have some relevance to these workshops, these programs, coming from the condensed matter point of view. So the whole thing is structured or in the way of, I want to think about it, that I'm going to be presenting you a menu, okay, and not actually giving you much, if anything, to eat. Only thing I'll present are some amuse-bouche. If you don't know what that means, it means amuse the mouth in French. But it's often used at fine dining restaurants as sort of a pre-appetizer. You go to a fancy restaurant, without ordering it, you will get a little taste of something. I tried to pick some examples of this kind throughout the talk. So that the two on here are two things are amuse-bouches from El Bulli, which you might know is a very famous restaurant, no longer open. Ferran Adrià, who's a sort of inventor of molecular gastronomy in Spain. So this is a sheep's milk frappuccino with black olive juice. And this is duck foie gras and mango caramels. So this is in keeping with the exotic theme of the physics. So food may be somewhat exotic. So speaking of exotic, there will be a number of exotic topics. I think Vincent, when he asked us to talk about this, kind of had in mind we would talk about exotic subjects. Because I'm going to be a bit superficial here, let me just, I want to point out that we have a lot of real experts in exotic physics on campus. I took the opportunity last week of polling all these locals, so Jaden Nyack, Simon Trepst, Andreas Ludwig, Chenka, Matthew Fisher. I put myself on there, how exotic your physics is, and these are the numbers they came up with. It's self-rated, okay, now.
So who is one?
Oh, this is least, one is least exotic, and 10 is most exotic. Who would be one would probably Bert Halperin or something, I don't know. You can decide, or maybe. I don't know. Anyway, you guys from outside UCSB probably think that the rating system is a little bit more like this. The plan here, as I said, is just to try and, in a way, sort of feel out the audience and see what is of interest. And I'm going to just offer up a few topics and describe them at a very kind of an overview level. That might be interesting to discuss later. I hope you'll interrupt a lot, if possible, with questions. It is so that might make it pedagogical. This is really very much just my personal view of topics that I think from condensed matter are of interest and might be fruitful for exploring as interplay with these two programs. So this is sort of the menu here at Chez KITP. I probably need a pointer here somewhere. There we go. I got it. You know, in fact, I'll just talk about sort of the specials here today. I'll talk a little bit about these subjects. He's not here. Someone remarked to me yesterday how happy they were that ITC was not discussed, so I'm afraid I'm gonna bring it up. These are subjects that I think we will certainly talk about at some level in the actual pedagogical lectures, but I'm not going to bring them up today in any detail. Just to say, if you want to hear about that, I'm sure Cenk will talk about quantum criticality. That's his plan. Frustrated magnetism, I've given quite a few lectures on this. If you want to just go to my website, you can read lectures on this. If there's a lot of interest, I'll talk about that in one of these other lectures. This is sort of my view of my audience. They're both doing simulations, as Matthias was telling us this morning. We have the quantum simulators, the cold atom people here, and the classical simulators working hard to keep up or outstrip them. There'll be a lot of talk about sort of details of how you do the simulations, but the main impression I got from the last month of the cold atom program is really anything is possible. And it's amazing how much progress people are making towards doing anything. I'm certainly very interested personally in getting into this field, but because so many things are possible, I keep asking myself the question, what's really interesting? So I'm going to take the point of view that, with these powerful, quote, simulation tools in hand, we can at least ask what would be interesting from the point of view of condensed matter to do here. Many of you are condensed matter physicists, so don't be offended that I'm pretending you're not. But in condensed matter theory, we have a number of motivations, and the main motivations in the field are sort of somewhat more applied, really understanding materials that occur in nature or that we can create, eventually in using these things for applications of some kind. But of course, as theorists, probably our internal motivations are much more fundamental. We want to develop fundamental theory, understand new ways that matter can organize itself, and emergent phenomena such as exotic phases or correlations, what are the excitations, different types of topology that might emerge in condensed matter systems. We want to understand mechanisms of phenomena that we sort of understand, like we understand what superconductivity is and its low energy properties, but how does it actually emerge in interesting systems like ITC? We can sort of ask, how can we take these motivations over to these other areas in terms of quantum and classical simulations? So sort of thinking about where this you might fruitfully make impact, these are four areas that occurred to me to talk about. This is what I'm going to try and cover today. Let me start with ITC. ITC is now almost 25 years old. It's certainly been by far the most active topic in condensed matter physics over that period, single topic. So it's kind of the meat and potatoes dish, if you want. It's got a bit of everything in it. Now this isn't ordinary meat and potatoes. This is Elysian Farms lamb ribeye with something a little bit exotic here, which you can't see, which is the neck of the lamb that's been stuffed in some way. This is from the French Laundry restaurant outside of San Francisco, one of the few relatively high Michelin-starred restaurants in the U.S. I don't know, two or three stars? Or three stars. You all know, have seen these kind of caricatures, phase diagrams, and tons of talks on ITC, even in cold atoms. Despite the age and maturity of the topic, it's still so easy to ask questions that we don't understand about ITC. Like, what are the necessary features for it? This is a somewhat applied question in some sense, but it's a question we would like to be able to answer to be able to actually use the phenomena to find it in other systems. Is it really two-dimensional? Do we need proximity to a Mott insulator? Are antiferromagnetic fluctuations a key ingredient? Does it have to be a single band system? The charge transfer material, you might not know what that means, but it operates R1. Is the Hubbard model sufficient? So cold atom people are trying to answer that. From a little bit more fundamental point of view, we can ask questions about the unusual features of the cuprates. Is there an underlying quantum critical point that's important? What's the nature of the strange metallic phase? There's this pseudo gap. Is it a distinct phase or something else? Is there inhomogeneity that's important? I'm sure you've seen these pretty STM pictures. Are exotic excitations or phases present? And again, are they important? Are they nearby? So these are all questions that people have struggled with and work on still all the time in high TC. And yet, we don't really know the answers to any of them. I'm sure you can come up with your own favorite 20 questions of high TC. One thing that quantum simulators do, you guys in Cold Atoms have taken up the charge of trying to emulate high TC, which I think is really a great idea, simulating the Hubbard model, which most of us believe contains the main ingredients for high TC. I find these amusing things. Find these statements from the government and the military as what they're actually going to do in these programs kind of amusing. I actually downloaded this crazy movie for the people in the other program. I don't know if you've not seen it, but I need the sound. I'm going to tell you all these ones.
An artificial material whose behavior is covered by the same underlying mathematics.
Okay, we don't have to watch the whole thing, but I like where they zoom into the computer. This is pretty great. Look at that. Inside your computer is going to be this cold atoms in an optical lens. It's fantastic. So, we're not there yet, but maybe cold atoms will manage to do this. Now, what you may not be aware of, which I wanted to inform you of, is that actually there are efforts within condensed matter itself to emulate high TC. Okay, and it's a sort of an increasingly growing activity, actually. In particular, people are more and more trying to sort of grow designer-correlated materials that, even though we don't really understand what makes high TC work, we can try and mimic the chemistry of high TC, create the same, something like a Hubbard model within a material that's completely different from a cuprate. Okay, and in that way, try and re-achieve high TC superconductivity, maybe with better parameters, and understand better what's going on. This is really actually part of a bigger program that's a developing technique to, instead of rely on just growing crystals or bulk materials, engineer the materials the way you engineer semiconductor samples, growing them layer by layer, one crystal unit cell at a time. This area is called mod interfaces or mod heterostructures or oxide interfaces. And I think it's a pretty exciting, actually, area in quantum condensed matter. And there's a lot of need for, certainly for classical simulation, to understand what these things are here, and eventually quantum simulation, if you actually have one working. Certainly should be inspiration for new models. So let me tell you about a couple of examples. So this is a very neat proposal by Karl Julian, who's in Germany, to basically take a material, lanthanum nickelate, and it's LANIO3, make a thin layer of it in a sort of a heterostructure with some other material. They suggested lanthanum aluminate, but there's some other things that are possible. By sort of confining these nickel atoms, you can lower their symmetry, and if you do this in the right way, you can split the doubly degenerate orbital. It's something called an EG orbital. It's doubly degenerate, this twofold multiplet of orbitals that look something like this in a solid state. You could split them in such a way that the unpaired electron sits in one particular orbital, which has the same symmetry as dx squared minus y squared orbital as the symmetry where the active electrons actually are in the cuprates. Okay, this actually was a quite inspiring, simple but inspiring proposal, and a number of experimentalists are working on these materials now, actually producing various heterostructures, sort of multi-layers of lanthanum nickelate surrounded by other materials. These are some some data characterizing a sample that's actually grown here at UCSB, but Keimer's group, which is actually where Kelly Ullman is, has been doing a lot of this in Germany and many other groups, actually. You'll see this sort of an explosion of this material notice on the ConMat in the last year or so. So far, it doesn't work, okay? So you don't have to worry. They're not putting your atomic quantum simulator out of a job yet. But nevertheless, there is some competition.
Excuse me, what does it mean it doesn't work?
Okay, yeah. lanthanum nickelate in the bulk is a mod insulator, is a metal. So one attempts to confine this thing and produce some kind of mod insulator, which you would hope would be an antiferromagnet to start out with. And then you could try doping it and all the kind of things that we would do to see high TC. So in thin films, this stuff actually does become a mod insulator when they confine it. But it doesn't appear to be an antiferromagnet. It appears to be a different kind. Actually, there's a guess that these are charge ordered. So not working at the moment. I mean, the simplest statement is that there's no superconductivity, but I think that even the mod insulating state is wrong. This was a very simple idea, and probably even theoretically, we think in this particular system, it's probably not going to work, although it will be very interesting in any case. Here's another example that I like better, I think is more likely to actually work. This is a material that exists in single crystals, something called strontium iridate. It actually has the same crystal structure as La2CuO4, which is one of the prototypical parent undoped compounds for the high TC materials. The electronic configuration is very different. Instead of having 9d electrons, it only has 5. But it's also, the iridium here is also a 5d transition metal element. It's so much heavier, it has a much, much larger spin orbit coupling. And as a consequence of this very big spin orbit coupling, there are 3 degenerate orbitals, 6 including spin, which actually split in this way in the solid, such that the one unpaired electron ends up in just a non-degenerate Cramer's doublet. So as a result, the electrons near the Fermi energy here live in a single, kind of a single band Hubbard model, effectively behave like spin 1/2 and have a lattice that basically is the same symmetry, same kind of anisotropy as in the cuprates. And indeed, this material is has been measured optically to be a mod insulator. You can actually see separate transitions associated with transitions within the upper and lower Hubbard band. These are the J equals 1/2 states, and then transitions to these J equals 3/2 states that are deeper down. And most importantly, this thing actually is an ordered square lattice antiferromagnet. And some really beautiful measurements I don't have time to tell you about using inelastic X-ray scattering, which is a kind of very novel technique for measuring magnetism. But in which it's seen that actually this material has a very large exchange coupling, very much like the cuprates, about 1,000 kelvin. So the trick is doping this thing. It seems to behave very much like a cuprate, in fact. There's one difference, which is theoretically interesting, which is that if you kind of look at this picture, you can see the spins are sort of tilted a little bit left and right here. So they're canted quite a bit more than in the cuprates. In the cuprates, this canting angle is less than a degree. Here it's about 10 degrees. And this is a result of the fact that there's very strong spin orbit coupling. So the one difference between this and high TC that's probably important is that these are very strong spin orbit coupling systems. So that difference is an interesting one for us as theorists to explore. But otherwise, probably this seems it's a very similar problem to the cuprates. There's nothing published on this, but in fact, in Japan, where all these experiments are happening, they've been able to dope iridium for ruthenium and rhodium, doping with rhodium is kind of isoelectronic, but reduces the spin orbit coupling, and doping with ruthenium is introducing hole doping. So they actually can dope the thing, and indeed they observe metal insulator transitions. Is this actually working? Well, so far, no superconductivity. We can talk about why that might be, but still, I think it's a very promising and interesting system. So this leads to a sort of problem to explore, which is something I'm trying to think about, is you can ask the question, we take this kind of prototypical phase diagram for the cuprates, which we think has something to do with the Hubbard model, and add another axis to it, spin orbit coupling, can we fill in this new three-dimensional phase diagram? Okay, that's a good problem for classical and quantum simulators. Theorists of any kind. Okay. Okay. You should ask questions if you have any. Maybe it's too superficial to generate any. Let me talk about, move on to the next subject, quantum spin liquids, which I'm sure people would like to hear about. What did I call this thing? So, you know, this is a very beautiful and deep and complex subject, and as such, it seemed appropriate to put some beautiful and complex and very unusual dish on here. So this is also from Ferran Adria's restaurant. It's something called Oysters on a Trip, which involves some very complicated concoctions of foams and things. Okay. So quantum spin liquids, it's actually something you can, you'll hear about tomorrow if you're interested. Rajiv Singh, I think I put an advert, is going to give a talk about this. There he is, tomorrow afternoon. So I may have too much content on this. I'll skip a little bit. So what is a quantum spin liquid? It's a state in which you have local moments, spins, but they manage to avoid ordering by quantum fluctuation somehow. And that's sort of the simple-minded way of saying it. Probably a better thing to say is a quantum spin liquid is some quantum system with a ground state with exotic structure, such as behaving as though it has emergent gauge fields or has other structure like topological order, has fractional quasiparticles, some exotic features like this. So there's sort of two problems, main problems in the field, and to my mind, really the main problem in the field of quantum spin liquids is where to find them. Okay. And the secondary problem, which is a purely theoretical one, is how to distinguish them from themselves, from others, or from any other state. So if you're interested in this, I wrote a little review article in this in Nature last year. Yeah, okay, Rajiv Singh's talk tomorrow, 1:30 p.m. So you'll hear a lot more about this if you come to this talk. So I'll just try and give kind of a very simple-minded overview of what they are, and then try and connect to cold atoms a little bit. So probably people have all seen these pictures. You know, back already in the 70s, Phil Anderson kind of envisioned the possibility of a quantum spin liquid, which he called a resonating valence bond state. So the idea was to just imagine a wave function which electron spins were paired up into singlets, but they weren't paired up in any specific singlet. You could just construct a superposition of many different pairings into singlets in such a way that the net wave function didn't really have any particular spin paired with any other spin. That's what it means to be resonating. These little marks here represent singlets or valence bonds. That's the valence bond in the RVB. So you can envision various different kinds of states you can build up with valence bonds. The simplest kind is what we call a valence bond solid, in which they don't resonate. A particular spin is forming a valence bond preferentially with some particular other spin. Okay, and that's not what most of us call a spin liquid, even though it's a non-magnetic state. The simplest sort of real spin liquid state, it would be some sort of a state in which spins are always paired up with nearby other spins. This is sometimes called a short range RVB state. But the pairing is still highly superimposed. So there's no specific spin that spin is paired with, but it's always paired with a nearby one. So generally, we expect that a short-range RVB state is a state that's going to have an energy gap. It'll cost some energy to create a magnetic excitation because you have to break up one of these singlets. Okay, and the singlet is sort of enforced by the nearest neighbor exchange of order J. On the other hand, you can have other states in which spins are always paired up, but the singlets are formed from further apart spins. And so the further apart they are, the weaker that binding into the singlet should be. So it's very natural to expect that if these pairs extend to very long distances, such a state should have gapless spin excitations. Okay. This makes it sound kind of simple, but you know, in reality, there are many, many ways in which you could arrange these singlets, and many, many ways, even more ways, to arrange the weights for each one of these pairings. So there's a huge number of such wave functions you could write down. And as you can imagine, then a huge number of distinct kinds of states. One thing that we do expect generally in a spin liquid in one of these RVB states, I don't know how to get this thing to run again. Click on that again. Does that do it? Nope. You don't need to see the movie again. There it goes. Any one of these RVB states actually supports exotic fractional excitations, which we call spin-ons, which are neutral excitations with spin 1/2. If you have an ordinary magnet in which spins are ordered, the only excitations you have actually are spin one, because you flip a spin from down to up. It changes the spin by one. So having an excitation in the system with spin one half, even for spin one half spins, is a very exotic thing. In 1D, this happens because you can have a kind of non-local excitation, which is a domain wall. This movie was meant to show this, but probably most of you know about this in any case, so I'm not going to explain it. In one dimension, a domain wall between two types of domains can act like a spin-on, and it's not that surprising that these things exist in one dimension, because even though they're non-local, the only energy cost for a domain wall is right at the boundary. Okay. The thing is, if you try to create a spin-on in a similar way in higher dimensions, it doesn't really work. You can try and create sort of a non-local object by flipping a string of spins, like this. We start with some anti-ferromagnet, and then I flip all these red spins over here. That creates we thought of as creating something like a spin one half excitation in this yellow position. But in doing it, you incur a very large energy cost because you've changed the energy of all the bonds above and below this string. And if this yellow spin-on were to try and move around, the further it moved, the bigger the string would get and the more energy it would cost. So in a magnetically ordered state, we generally do not expect to have spin-on excitations like this. In an RVB state, it's possible, just because even though we still have to flip an infinite number of spins in some sort of string to create this non-local excitation, flipping those spins might not cost any energy. And the reason is that the state itself is a superposition of so many different spin configurations that when you flip spins, all you do is permute these different configurations around. So you could basically get back to the same spin configuration when you flip these spins. So that's the idea, is that as a consequence of that, as the spin-on moves around, it doesn't have to actually incur any energy cost, even though spins sort of have to be flipped component by component. Now I'm giving this at a very hand-waving level. I'll say a little bit more at a slightly less hand-waving level. Probably the best way that we understand these spin liquid states these days is by sort of slave particle approaches, which are, you can think of at one level as a way of producing this kind of RVB wave function. So it's a technical procedure. You take a Hamiltonian of free particles, free fermions here, any Hamiltonian you want. Here's a simple Hubbard-like model with a BCS pairing term. And you find its ground state. And that's a reference Hamiltonian. It's not the physical Hamiltonian in your system. And that produces some reference ground state. And that'll be some state. Could be a Fermi C. It could be a BCS state. It's some determinant, Slater determinant. It's not a spin wave function. So we'll have plenty of amplitude to have zero or two fermions on one site. So then what we do is we project this just onto the sector where there's one and only one fermion on a site. And then we get a spin wave function. And that's a variational wave function, which always can be written in the form of this kind of resonating valence bond state. So this is a way of constructing many, many variational wave functions by choosing different forms of these Hamiltonians. And one thing you notice is that you can construct gauge transformations on this reference state, meaning you multiply the wave function by a phase factor that depends on the site, which actually leave the variational state unchanged because of the projection. And as a consequence, one sort of sees as a certain gauge structure to these variational wave functions. And it's actually believed that these wave functions sort of characterize a particular phase, which can be described, its physical properties actually described by a gauge theory. In which this kind of gauge symmetries of this projected state, this reference state, if you want, are reflected in sort of physical emergent gauge fields that actually appear in physical properties. And so different quantum spin liquid phases are characterized at least partly by the nature of these gauge fields. There are U1 gauge fields, which are like the gauge fields in electromagnetism, or Z2 gauge fields, which are discrete, or even more complicated things than that.
Could you explain the terminology? Who's the slave of whom there?
Who's a slave? Okay, yeah. So the terminology is that, that's a good. So this really originates, there are different ways of understanding it, but this originates from a slightly different problem, not just studying magnetic Hamiltonians, but studying electron ones, in which you you start with just an electron operator, and you introduce, to represent it, let's say a boson and a fermion operator, where the boson carries a charge and the fermion carries a spin. And that's a redundant description. So both of those things are sort of, if you want, slaved to the original electron operator. So once introducing extra states, but forcing those states to always appear in a particular way so that nothing unphysical in the end is done. It's a mathematical construction. So here one is doing something sort of similar, introducing fermions even though the underlying spins are just involve a two-state system. These fermions look like they have more than two states. On a site you could have four states. No fermions, one up, one down, or an up and a down fermion. So you force these fermions to be the slaves.
So this reference Hamiltonian doesn't necessarily span all possible RVV states that you wrote.
No.
Some subset of the possible.
That's right. So you can try and enlarge this, and there are ways to improve on this. And there's lots of attempts to explore this. I mean, it's a huge space, right? So this is a way of producing wave functions that have a certain degree of locality. They have a correspondence that we understand to a certain extent with effective field theories. And which can be manipulated in somewhat useful ways. We talked, at this lunch session the other day about having useful wave functions that you can work with. So these are in that class. More questions? Certainly.
Is there an in situ invariant spin Hamiltonian which shows a U1 gauge photon?
Is there an SU2
model which shows the gauge photon?
Yeah, probably, but we don't know. I don't know. SU2 is it? That's okay. I don't know. There's certainly U1 invariant Hamiltonians in three dimensions, which I believe do. SU2. I'm not aware of such a construction, but maybe one can come up with one. Okay. Okay. So. We already brought up the fact that these Hamiltonians are not complete, in describing all possible RVB states, but they still describe a huge set of possible wave functions. And so this set of RVB wave functions is actually really vast. It's believed that the number of distinct quantum spin liquid phases, that is, wave functions that really describe distinct phases, is also vast. Maybe not as vast as this, uncountably infinite set of wave functions, but still vast. So for instance, Xiaogan Wen classified hundreds of different quantum spin liquid states just on the square lattice with no symmetry breaking. If you start allowing symmetry breaking or go to other lattices, no doubt one can come up with many more hundreds of states. So this means one has a huge space of different possible states to compare with. As I like to say, this is a baby version of the landscape problem in string theory. I saw Joe back there somewhere reading his email. But so this is the landscape problem of quantum spin liquid physics that, far from not having candidate quantum spin liquid states, we have way too many quantum spin liquid states in theory. We don't even really understand all these states. One can sort of write down wave functions, but we don't know necessarily what those mean. We believe that many quantum spin liquid states are not simple at all. They're described by non-trivial interacting quantum field theory with non-trivial exponents and things. Each one would requires some detailed analysis. There are many, many candidates, which actually it raises a problem. And many people sort of outside the field think that there is a quantum spin liquid, and we just have to find it. But theoretically, actually, there are many, many quantum spin liquids. We don't even know which one to look for. Okay. I guess about a year and a half ago, I gave lectures at the Boulder Summer School about frustrated magnets and made up this little flow chart, just a caricature of what you would tell an experimentalist to search for if they were looking for quantum spin liquids. First they figure out what the dimension of their system is it two or three, and if it's two, then you could try and distinguish different spin liquids by determining whether there's a spin gap. If there was, you probably expect this. If there isn't, then you need more detailed information because there are actually many states that don't have a spin gap. Measure the specific heat, and depending on the outcome, you can expect different kinds of states. And this table continues because the theory of quantum spin liquids is different in three dimensions. You have to go down to the second branch of the table and follow all these things. So, there's no simple short answer to the question, how do I characterize a quantum spin liquid, and how do I detect it in an experiment? You need a little bit more information. I've sort of given you the story that there are a lot of quantum spin liquids, and in theory there are, but the sort of paradox is that there are actually no clear demonstrations of quantum spin liquids in experiment. So Rajiv will probably update you on that tomorrow. Probably thousands of quantum antiferromagnets have been studied in experiment, and almost all of them order. There are a few now that don't, but it's not so easy to find. So in condensed matter physics, of course people have asked the question, where would you really look for quantum spin liquids? And sorts of things that people believe are useful are having maximum quantum effects, which for SU2 spins seem to be, you'd expect would be maximized when we have the smallest spin possible, S equals a half spins, but maybe this isn't necessary. Frustration is probably a good thing. It tends to suppress ordering, which kind of competes with quantum spin liquids. And one of the things that people have focused on a little more recently is that other sources of fluctuations, such as charge fluctuations, proximity to a Mott transition, may actually be important. I tend to believe that this is actually a good thing to try and include when looking for quantum spin liquids. We'd be interested, more likely to find them probably in Hubbard models and Heisenberg models. So here's some pictures of various different materials that are sort of on the table as possible quantum spin liquids. Probably Rajiv will talk about these tomorrow. It's easier to look at words in this table. So there are a number of triangular lattice organic magnets. There are a number of Kagame lattice inorganic materials. And there's this interesting hyper-Kagame lattice material in three dimensions. My own group has been looking recently at some rather different systems, hoping to expand this table. That's something if there were interest, I could tell people about. Just want to make a comment that quantum spin liquids is not all there is in the universe of quantum magnetism or frustrated magnetism. There are a lot of other interesting phenomena that sort of fit into spin liquids experimentally. They're interesting magnetic systems where there are very strong fluctuations, but we know that the ground states are not quantum spin liquids or something else. This is just a list of some interesting materials that show a variety of different phenomena. So
what is the something else that they are?
Different things. So many systems, you have kind of minimal quantum effects, but you have strong thermal fluctuations. So you can have a state where ordering is suppressed not by quantum fluctuations, but thermal fluctuation. That can happen in a variety of different ways. So these are, you might call them classical spin liquids rather than quantum spin liquids, or materials like this. Then there are there's a whole universe of materials that we just don't understand what it is. We pretty much know that it's not quantum spin liquids, but it's something else, maybe weird kind of freezing, other behavior that we just don't understand. So let me get back to you. So cold atoms in particular, of course people have asked the question, can we look for quantum spin liquids? And there are kind of two strategies you could imagine. One is that we do have a variety of soluble spin models that are actually quantum spin liquids. There's something that's been accomplished in the field in the last decade or so. For instance, this famous Kitaev honeycomb model. One approach is, since you can do anything in cold atoms, is to try and make these. To my mind, that's a little bit less satisfying, but it's also difficult because these Hamiltonians tend to be rather fine-tuned. And because they're soluble, they usually have many conserved quantities, which probably means they're going to be very hard to equilibrate. So a different approach, which I think will also be, you know, more more useful for us in condensed matter, it's more likely to shed light on natural phenomena occurring in condensed matter materials, is to mimic the condensed matter experimental systems that are our best candidates. So I want to in particular mention the triangular lattice Hubbard model, which is probably the best studied model where we think theoretically that it's likely to have a quantum spin liquid phase. So there are kind of numerical results on this model going back to studies of Imada's group in 2002 up to the present day, giving stronger and stronger evidence for a quantum spin liquid state occurring here in this Hubbard model. It lies in between the metallic state at small u and an antiferromagnetically ordered state at large u in some range of parameters. It's not that precisely determined. And I was pleased to see in last week's conference that there now is actually progress to making these kind of triangular lattice structures in cold atoms. So actually other features of this particular problem that's kind of appealing from the point of view of cold atoms. So one is thinking about energy scales. So if you think about this Hubbard model, there's a kind of coherence scale below a temperature that you have to get below before you really get into close to the quantum mechanical ground state. And this is, of course, of order the Fermi energy, which is of order the Hopping when u is small. But as u gets large, it gets smaller and smaller, because eventually you have to get to the scale of exchange. And so that the larger u is, the harder this is. So where people have really seem to be focusing at the moment in cold atoms is getting into the antiferromagnetic phase in this large u region. Okay, and that's hard. If you can find interesting physics in the intermediate coupling region, it should actually be easier because this coherence energy is higher. Now, this quantum spin liquid phase occurs exactly in this region where everything, all the energy scales are basically comparable. And in particular, you can think about the charge gap here, which would again also become of order the bandwidth in this intermediate region. So in hunting for the quantum spin liquid phase, it's kind of ideal, actually, it seems to me, to be in this sweet spot here. So if I were to try and guide cold atom experimentalists where to look, I would say you should be looking at these Hubbard-type models and intermediate coupling where we can expect something, not so much at spin models. And one expects this kind of thing to occur in other frustrated lattices. Okay, so which brings me to the third topic. I don't know if I'm going to make four, but we'll see how far we get.
Excuse me, do you want to comment on the fact that they found something theoretically on the honeycomb lattice, which is actually unfrustrated?
Yeah, so I wrote maybe unfrustrated ones too. That's about as much as I want to comment because I want to get on. So the general message would be that we don't really understand in any general way what's going on in these intermediate coupling regions. So there is some numerical evidence for a quantum spin liquid phase on the honeycomb lattice, you know, which you also have, these guys have also made, actually. So fermions on any of these lattices where we can expect some sort of intermediate coupling Mott-like transition is an interesting place to look.
What would be the experimental signature for such quantum spin liquids?
That's another topic which would be wonderful to discuss, but I'm not going to discuss it now. Okay. It's a Mott insulator with no magnetic order. Okay, you want a signature of what it is rather than what it isn't. So for instance, in your kind of measurement, one might be able to see RKKY Friedel oscillations in the charge density, even though it's an insulator. Okay, that would be a pretty strange thing. So it's an insulator with a Fermi surface. It's a strange state. I want to turn to it. This brings me to another subject. If you look carefully at the picture I drew here of this Mott transition, I drew the charge gap here coming down and, of course, going to zero when you go from a Mott insulator to a metal. I drew two possibilities here, sort of a conventional one where this charge gap drops to zero and a dashed line suggesting that it might actually go smoothly to zero. So it's an interesting possibility and question to ask what really the nature of this Mott transition is in a fermion system, in a general lattice. And that's a very classic topic of condensed matter physics. It's another old and very rich topic, so to kind of emphasize that, I put, this is a picture of the Oaxacan black mole from a Gualeguetza restaurant in LA. You should go if you have a chance. It's cheap and extremely good. It's a very complex, traditional sauce, rich, but sometimes it's hard to tell what's in it. It's very much like the physics of the Mott transition. The Mott transition, what is it? So people talk about two kinds of Mott transitions. One is if you sit at fixed filling, say one electron per site, and you can imagine varying the strength of the Hubbard interaction, you have a transition from a metal to an insulator. This is called the bandwidth-tuned transition. But you can also sit in the Mott insulator and tune the transition by doping. This is called the filling-controlled Mott transition. So the bandwidth-controlled is somehow the more fundamental and interesting thing. This is an old subject. This is it's interesting to go back to Mott's original Reviews of Modern Physics paper on the Mott transition. He was actually wondering whether the Mott transition was discontinuous. This is the gap coming down and jumping, or continuous. And originally concluded it was probably a first order transition, but later in life he changed his mind and decided it could be continuous. It's hard in condensed matter to tune Mott transitions, because we usually can't actually tune our Hamiltonians. You can tune it a little bit with pressure, or sometimes with chemical doping. So there are not that many situations in which it's actually explored experimentally, but there are certainly those examples where it can be explored, we see mostly first order transitions. So here are some examples. I'm going to skip over them in inorganics and organics of these phase transitions. It's an old field, but it's seen a lot of recent development, especially the numericists in the disentangling program. Probably many of them are involved in this. There's kind of methods developed in the last couple of decades, LDA plus U, DMFT, and its improvements were talked about already. We'll hear more about them, no doubt, and other alternative numerical techniques. They're interesting from a physics point of view because many of the most interesting materials, a lot of the quantum spin liquid materials I mentioned, are actually believed to be close to a Mott transition. And also these heterostructures I talked about, these oxide interfaces, are providing a new way to probe the physics of the Mott transition, trying to engineer structures that undergo the Mott transition. So for instance, this is being done a lot in this lanthanum nickelate system I mentioned. Turns out that if you can find these lanthanum nickelate films down to a small number of unit cells, you can actually see a gap opening. This is photo emission data where you see that when the films get smaller than about 3 nanometers, a large excitation gap of about half an electron volt opens up. This is presumably a Mott gap system. The theoretical question, which I think is really interesting, is going back to the old question of Motts, which is, can the Mott transition actually be continuous? There have been some very nice theoretical papers by Senthol and Youngbek Kim and their collaborators in the last couple of years, giving a sort of a concrete scenario for this and arguing that it's internally consistent, at least, that a Mott transition can be continuous. If it is, it's an extremely interesting and exotic thing, because somehow it's a phase transition in which you have a metallic state with a whole Fermi surface of low energy excitations, which somehow all die. They all go away in the Mott transition. They all have to develop an energy gap all at once. How does this happen? It's a very strange thing, and dramatic thing from the point of view of quantum phase transitions. Nevertheless, there's some plausible scenarios. And I would argue in the same kind of fermionic Hubbard systems, and cold atoms is actually a great place to try and explore this. They're much more tunable. Again, this is intermediate coupling physics, which one could try and explore in these systems. Although one usually sees first order transitions in condensed matter systems, partly this may be due to not fundamental reasons. One reason that a lot of transitions end up being first order in condensed matter is that you have coupling to the compressible lattice, and this has a tendency to drive phase transitions first order. And also it's believed that these transitions are more likely to be continuous if you have a large number of fermion flavors. So these recent experiments on alkaline earth atoms look like they might be perhaps favorable for doing things like this. Although, okay. So in the last 10 minutes, I want to turn to the last topic, which is something that I work on quite a bit in my group and in research, which is spin orbit physics. So this is a picture of the quote Caesar salad from the French Laundry restaurant. It doesn't look like any conventional Caesar salad. It's been, you know, it's an old classic reinvented in interesting and surprising ways. So in a way, this is similar. Some of the recent developments in spin orbit physics are kind of reinventing classic old areas of solid state physics and discovering interesting phenomena. So we all know spin orbit physics. Spin orbit coupling is present in matter, and it gives rise to all kinds of different phenomena, from fine structure of atoms to magnetic anisotropy and ferromagnets, for instance. Recently, people have been exploring kind of stronger effects of spin orbit in condensed matter, like the spin Hall effect or the anomalous Hall effect. Most recently, and probably most excitingly, topological insulators, which I'm sure must somehow enter these workshops. It was even talked about last week at the cold atom workshop, where it seems somewhat unnatural to me. What I think is interesting about spin-orbit coupling, which has not been so much explored, is the interplay of spin-orbit coupling and interactions. I want to give you kind of a caricature of how this, of the physics here. So, imagine taking a tight binding model that would describe the hopping of some electrons or particles on a lattice, including in addition spin-orbit coupling, and then in addition Hubbard interaction between these fermions. So in this way, we have two-dimensionless parameters, U over T and lambda over T, and we can kind of draw a two-dimensional phase diagram. So then we can try and understand what the different limits mean. So we know that as we increase lambda over T, we're going from a regime of weak spin-orbit coupling to strong spin-orbit coupling. And when the U is small, the crossover between these two has to happen when lambda is of order T. It's the only dimensionless parameter. That's when lambda is bigger than T, it's much bigger than the bandwidth. Spin-orbit states are very far split. They sort of form separate bands, whereas when lambda is small, we have bands that are very weakly perturbed by spin-orbit coupling. But when U is large, actually, the effects of spin orbit are actually enhanced, because up here we have actually a mod insulator. And effectively, the fermions don't move very much. So their bandwidth is very much reduced. And as a consequence, lambda, the spin orbit, doesn't have to compete with the full kinetic energy. It just competes with a much reduced kinetic energy. In particular, you can think of, in the large U limit, you can derive a Heisenberg Hamiltonian. And then lambda really should be compared not with T, but with J, which is T squared over U. So up here, actually, lambda needs to only be of order T squared over U rather than of order T. That's why the line dividing weak and strong spin orbit bends to the left.
So how do I
notice things? Anyway, just use the keyboard.
Ask a question. So this is like a modification to the Hubbard model. So for this second term, the spin orbit coupling, how does it work with L? It's like low on one side?
So that's a good question. So in condensed matter, where you would run into this for the most part is situations in which you have some orbital degeneracy. So the L is kind of an operator which lives in the orbital subspace. Okay. So we can discuss various situations in which that happens. But
so I have a related question. So as you just mentioned that you want to compare the strength of spin-orbit coupling to the to J.
Yeah.
But I guess it depends on exactly how many optos are occupied in the mod side. Because if I only have one opto per side that's occupied, the angular momentum, if you take the perturbation value, angular momentum is zero.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so this is really for situations with orbital degeneracy. Otherwise, it becomes trivial up here. So those are the interesting situations. So this is, we could talk about when that happens. Okay. All right. So I want to draw another line on here, which is the line not separating weak and strong spin orbit, but separating weak and strong interactions. So obviously, this is U of order the bandwidth when spin orbit is zero. And it's still pretty much U of order the bandwidth when spin orbit is large. The only difference is that typically spin orbit, when you introduce it, will split some of the degeneracies in your Hamiltonian, and then you'll have less bands that are near the Fermi energy. And as a consequence, in typical situations, at least in condensed matter, this line will move down somewhat, but not a lot. It's almost a horizontal line. So then we kind of divided up the plane into four regions here where we can expect different behavior. It's too bad this thing is dying on me, but it always dies. It's amazing it worked this long. Apple makes a lot of nice products, but their remote control is terrible. So in the lower left-hand corner, we have kind of, if you want, conventional materials, simple materials, where maybe band theory works reasonably well, where neither correlations nor spin orbit effects are that strong. Over here, we have kind of weakly correlated materials, but with strong spin orbit physics. And this is where most of the exciting spin orbit physics has actually been found recently in condensed matter, in particular, all these topological insulators, interesting semi-metallic spin orbit systems, they all live here. Over here, in this region of large, strong correlations but weak spin orbit, this is where most of the study of the Mott transition and Mott insulators lives. So 3D transition metal oxides, for most quantum magnets that people have focused on kind of live in this region. So, you know, this leaves, obviously, the rest of the diagram, which I've drawn in this, you know, suggestive way, but I think is more or less correct, which is actually the biggest region of the phase diagram, where we have Mott insulators with strong spin orbit coupling. And probably the most interesting region of this whole diagram is this kind of boundary here, near the phase boundary here, where all these effects are kind of comparable. Okay, there is a region where a lot of theorists are working lately, where there seem to be a lot of prospect for exotic phenomena. We believe this happens in certain condensed matter materials like iridium oxides. And there have been various proposals for interesting phenomena that can happen in this regime, sort of interacting versions of topological insulators or magnetic versions of topological insulators. It's a very nice proposal by Sergei Savrasov and Ashvin Vishwanath and company for some interesting three-dimensional Dirac fermions emerging in this region. If we come back actually to this region, even up here, I would like to claim there's a lot of room for interesting physics with the strong spin orbit and strong Mott. So these are a region where both the spin orbit coupling and the correlations are strong. So this commonly occurs in F-electron systems, but here all the energy scales are very low and often there's a lot of Kondo physics and things going on. In transition metals, you actually have to work sort of hard to find this phenomena. There are a couple of examples that we've looked into recently, which I don't have time to tell you about, but just to say that, just to say that if you do explore systems of this type, there's some interesting things to be found. In particular, we believe that multipolar order is very common in systems like this. So usual magnetism is what I would call dipolar order. So you have spontaneous dipole moments forming. In this region, you can have spontaneous higher multipole moments forming. And there's also a reason that materials in this regime should expect magnetism with very strongly enhanced quantum fluctuations. So that's the end. I think it's pretty much right on an hour, so I'll stop for now. And thanks for your time.
On your last phase diagram, is there a region you can say is really important from a spintronics point of view?
I mean, most of current spintronics is, is in the strong weak correlation region, but I do think that this region here, confusing this controller. Here we go. This intermediate coupling region here is actually probably pretty important because there are a lot of interesting things you can do if you can actually make make magnetism intrinsic to materials with strong spin orbit. And magnetism is intrinsically a correlation phenomena. It's interesting to explore these kinds of materials in the context of finding strong spin orbit coupling materials that are, for instance, ferromagnetic, or even antiferromagnetic, interesting structures. So I think that probably is something that potentially will have a technological impact. But this part of the talk was certainly not technologically motivated in any way. But,
so I understand that we are trying to catch up on the lower line for the moment, but I would say that in principle, this is only because, at least from the theoretical point of view, we have learned how to solve the single particle Hamiltonians quickly. So we go on this line. But of course, you know that atomic systems, in principle, you have these interactions. So it's very, in fact, you have to do something in order to avoid them, which we do with our Fresnel resonances. But in principle, the line to the right, the idea is with this artificial gauge field to do it either for, let's say, time universal breaking insulators like the half typical normal half systems, or with something which I call an Abelian gauge field, which is very similar to spin orbit coupling. But anyway, allows you to get these topological insulators included with these things. And there are people working on that, like Jan Spielmann. But in principle, in the models that you are looking at, usually you are looking at non-interacting things, and of course the interactions are there. So this region should be, if they really realize this kind of couplings, then they will automatically have also interactions.
Yeah, I mean, so I think in terms of conceptual novelty, the region of interacting kind of strong spin orbit systems, interacting topological insulators is much more open and not understood, and it's something where that there's room for discovery type research rather than reproductive research. It's a bad word to use, but
I just want to make sure I understand. In this case, this nominal term actually is a interaction term.
So like no, it's not an interaction.
Is a quantum confused?
No, so you would you would sandwich this with a fermion creation operator and annihilation operator on the left and right. This is all single particle. This is single particle. Only U is.
It only couples coherently. Yeah. So it's for us it's like a Raman transition on site.
Yeah. I mean, there are even simpler examples than this that are maybe interesting. So I mentioned this strontium iridate material at the beginning where, you know, that really is a non-degenerate single band system, but in which spin orbit is intrinsic in a way. So that could potentially, you know, be realized. That doesn't require as many degrees of freedom. It's kind of just a two species system would be sufficient to explore that kind of physics principle. That's a small twist on the current whatever optical lattice emulator story.
So you gave two definitions of quantum spin electrodes. One of them was, you know, quantum fluctuations of short order, and the second was something interesting happens then.
Yeah, I didn't really give either any definitions, if you wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, or two descriptions, if you will. But I mean, how sure can you be that, you know, it's a lot easier to see that there's no magnetic order than see that there's something interesting going on. So how sure can you be, given the first, that you have the second?
Okay. Well, I would argue it's probably much easier to see something interesting going on than to tell that you don't have some particular order. Maybe it's just very weak. But in any case, that's more of an experimental question. But okay, so that connection is sort of established in some subclass of systems. So if we know, I mean, Matthew mentioned this at this overview before. There are these theorems that have been proved by Hastings and others, other arguments that are maybe not quite at the level of theorems, but by Masaki Yoshikawa here, that if we have a system, let's say, of fermions with an odd number of spin 1/2 fermions with an odd number of electrons per unit cell, this applies also to spin models with a half integer spin per unit cell. If no symmetries are broken, we know there has to be some. We believe there has to be some exotic structure to the state. Okay, what the theorems really concern ground state degeneracy in the thermodynamic limit. There's some conceptual connection there, but
That works in three dimensions as well as two.
Yeah. So, I think on physical grounds that the arguments in that case are very solid. But of course, we could still have these exotic states on lattices that don't satisfy that. You know, so these recent numerics on the honeycomb lattice Hubbard model, that has integer spin per unit cell, and nevertheless could harbor a spin liquid state. And so that the exact conditions under which a featureless spin liquid state, a featureless ground state is possible that's not exotic, I don't think that's established. Okay.
So you were mentioning these interacting topological insulators. And in this context, I wanted to ask you about, I'm curious about that classification. I mean, you know how to classify non-interacting topological insulators. We can do it by band structure or field theory, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you have interactions, how do you classify topological insulators interacting beyond the mean field?
No idea. Basically, no ideas. I mean, so let me. What I want to say is I want to point out the difficulty of the problem. Okay, we only learned about topological insulators. If you were paying attention, you might have learned about them 5 years ago. But most people learned about them about a year ago or two. Okay, so people have been trying to understand spin liquid states in SE2 invariant systems, no spin orbit, for decades. Okay, and we know that as I mentioned, that there's some huge landscape of possible quantum spin liquid states with no spin orbit at all. Okay, so the classification problem of interacting topological phases is much, much more complex. So adding spin orbit to it is only making it worse. Okay, so you should not expect any simple results. That's my feeling. Okay, there may be simple results to be had if you completely give up on symmetry. Okay, so there are some results in one dimension by Oshikawa and others. Very active topic, actually, classifying interacting topologically distinct phases in one dimension. And there it's possible to make some progress. I would say there's not so much progress in two dimensions even. But even there, making progress requires sort of restricting the number of symmetries to be very, very minimal. And that's interesting and important, but real systems, even in condensed matter, symmetry is important. And cold atoms, unless you do something by hand, you really have you have clean systems. You don't have disorder to break symmetries. So I think that's just an extremely difficult and rich problem. You can't expect simple answers.
As far as these strongly spin orbit and strongly interacting systems concerned, are there some that exist strontium relay? Are there new, will it require new experimental matters, like high-density led to development of many new experimental techniques? So does the presence of strong spin orbit somehow take something away from the experimental tools? Or does
probably it adds to the experimental tools in most cases, because it means that there are additional interactions there to distinguish phenomena that weren't there before. So for instance, probes like the anomalous Hall effect yield much, much bigger responses experimentally in strong spin orbit coupled systems than they do in weakly spin orbit coupled systems. So certain experimental probes are easier to use on these materials. Now, I think the arsenal of experimental tools in the heap rates certainly can be applied here. The main delay experimentally is just producing good materials, as it was in the Cooper rates.
As far as this particular material is concerned, does it really use this strontium?
You're trying to get to photo emission and STM. Honestly, I don't know. I mean, it's very similar to lanthanum cuprate. So, I think these things are probably on their way if they haven't already been attempted. But there are some difficulties. So, iridium oxides. Unfortunately, iridium is a very strong neutron absorber. So, this is one of the main problems in those systems, is that neutron scattering is very hard. For any of the 5D systems near iridium, actually, they strongly absorb neutrons. But the plus is that this new technique, which has been developed in the cuprates and other things, the inelastic X-ray scattering, turns out to be much more sensitive in those systems. There's a very nice transition at just the right energies. for doing those measurements, nice resonant transition. So the magnetic structure I showed was not determined by neutrons, it was determined by X-ray scattering, actually. The first, maybe the first example where a magnetic structure has been determined by X-ray scattering. But, so no, I don't think they're especially difficult in that regard. I'm not an experimentalist.
Just a comment about the transcendental experiment. So the moment what they're trying to do is the hertz-triangular lattice that they somehow modulate it dynamically in order to invert the sign of tunneling for the boson. So what they will study in this moment is moderate coupling Hubbard-Mohr-Hubbard for bosons with inverted sign of tunneling, which let's say in Hubbard boson limit corresponds to XY model anti-ferromagnetic, which also should show speed liquids, but I don't know what happens in the intermediate coupling. You tell me. So bosons with inverted T.
Yeah.
And you, let's say, a little bigger than T.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's as interesting. I mean, I think that leads to different magnetic ordered phases. These kind of things have been studied, but this is somewhat like an XY anti-ferromagnet on the triangle.
Well, the XY is in this case, the magnetism is bound by presence or absence of bosons.
I understand. Right. But if you look at the anti-ferromagnetic XY model on the triangular lattice, which is kind of that, I mean, that orders would be expected to be a BC at a which is condensing at some finite momentum rather than at zero momentum, basically. Condensing at some zone boundary. I don't know. So this is just off the top of my head. But, I think fermions are the.
But we can put fermions also on top of that.
Actually, I have a question. In the first
So actually, you don't like the dessert? I took this picture in Paris last.
So when you add the, so is the spin liquid possible? You, I'm thinking about the lava direct. This thing you can be doping, right?
Ah, okay. Yeah, okay, that's further back.
So
yeah, all right.
So this is all for the case when it's like half cleaning. So the question is, spin liquid still possible when the doping is not? I mean, when the doping is added to the system.
Yeah, so.
How will we understand?
So I don't believe that a spin liquid per se, meaning an actual state with a charge gap and no broken symmetries, is really possible. It's some incommensurate doping. But you can have elements of spin liquid physics. So in the second sense, that you have an exotic state with some unconventional excitations, it's certainly. That's what we call a non Fermi liquid state, what Matthew was calling non Fermi liquid state. That's certainly possible in a doped system. So, but in fact, much less understood theoretically than these simple commensurate values. So that if you start venturing into, I claim that classification of quantum spin liquids is already very complicated, but at least it's developed. If you try and ask about classification of non-Fermi liquids, almost no framework there, really, and much fewer proof of principles as well. So, in this audience, at least on the disentangling side, probably most people believe that a large fraction of the audience would already believe that quantum spin liquids exist in principle, probably. But I don't know how big a fraction of that audience would believe that non-Fermi liquids exist in principle. It'd be an interesting poll to do.
What's the definition of non-Fermi?
Non-banana.
Yeah.
the definition, I don't know. Not adiabatically continuous to a free fermion system. You could definition, I didn't even really define quantum spin liquid for you. So there are various definitions. A metal where the Fermi surface doesn't obey Luttinger's theorem. Or a metal in which there's no quasi-particle pole as you approach the Fermi surface. There are various definitions you could try and give. But we don't have...
But you specify the system should be some fermion system.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's not too surprising not to have a Fermi liquid if you have boson.
And also don't have any order, right?
Don't have any order. Well,
I mean, theoretically, such kind of model do exist. Actually, we can consider some exact sort of a model.
I didn't mean to say that they don't exist. I mean, yeah, sure, there are. It's, no doubt you guys have some constructions. I mean, I've seen constructions in the past, but.
Do you mean the non-Fermi liquid is always gapped, or they are also some gapless expectation?
I don't want to make any claims about non-Fermi liquids. <That's>,
All right, I think we're going to see Neil next time. Let's thank Neil for the.